I have some exciting news before we start. I just launched the Red Cheeks Academy with the first ever online workshop where you can learn about ethical production of intimate scenes. If you work with intimacy on screen in any capacity, this is for you. The workshop is for people who want to become intimacy coordinators. These can be cinematographers, producers, directors, or sex workers and performers who want to benefit from their experience. If this sounds interesting to you, head up to academy.redcheeks.org to submit your application for one of the first sessions. And don't forget to check out the FAQ page with info about scholarships. Now, let's start with the podcast. I like to dive in with my questions. I do not like to waste time. So right. The first one, and really, it's something I really like to ask people, because I'm curious how intimacy was treated in their house when they were growing up, in the near society, and how it influenced who you are today, if it influenced you at all. And I'm happy to share my experience also. I'm curious about you.
Yeah, that is a good one. I was born, as we just spoke offline for a while, I was born under the legendary Iron Curtain. So in famous Eastern Bloc side, that's me. And it's not hard to guess, it was full and based on the conservative and rather traditional values. And back then, marriage and then family were like kind of, I would say, holy grail for the society. So the reproduction was in a strong rage, and the intimacy would be rather kept in the backseat, something like that. Yeah. It's just like how I remember those days, you know.
Yeah.
And as I was born in the 80s, so naturally I grew up in the 90s and in Poland. And then things maybe shaked down a little bit because Poland began the journey of being the young democracy, and censorships losing the grips. And in general, probably it was easier to communicate the intimacy. But I have a feeling that in socialist kind of, societies, there was still no place for it. It was still very, very much like family-centric agenda. And the fact that systems are collapsing, it doesn't change the people, like from day to another. So I think, if I think, how did we as a kids or teenagers get any information whatsoever? It was intimacy or sexuality. We gathered it from our backyard wisdom. So you remember this
day? Yeah.
Running with a key around the neck. The famous generation with the key around the neck, like kind of artifact of the 80s and 90s and post-Soviet country block children. So we would share all the informations between each other, which were most likely myths and misconceptions about what intimacy, sexuality could be. And on the top of that, we were probably hunting accidentally for some leftover erotica, like Playboy magazine found in bushes, you know, something like that. And when I think about it, I'm like, I don't want to know what was behind those stories with these bushes, you know, who was touching those papers that we were often playing with. But that was source of knowledge. Bravo Girl.
Oh yeah,
that was
Bravo
like
Girl,
popular
yeah,
magazine. Yeah, right. It was like this love story section about losing the virginity, if I remember. So that was Secret Sauce, and I was a bookworm. Yeah. So I basically read everything back then, everything that was in the paper I wanted to read. And my grandmother, she had this big collection of Lady magazine, and there was also a section kind of advisory for women, married women, obviously. to be more, I don't know, acceptable, attractive, have to pleasure their husband. So So yeah, there you have, you know, basically blush face, stolen porn, yeah, lady magazine. That was whole intimacy concept and construct, I would say, I received that times.
Yeah, because I don't remember, like, as I mentioned it already a few times on the podcast, that for me also there was a biology class, but that was like, you know, reproductive.
Mm-hmm. Reproduction.
Like, how the babies are happening, you know, how it's like babies, how do you do it? And yeah, religion, there was some... because, yeah, I don't know if you had to go to religion classes, but for me, I had to. So I'm laughing that that was my, you know, intimacy in quotes, how the family should look like, you know, how do you interact with your husband, because it has to be husband, other options
to be husband,
you don't have,
yeah.
yes you don't have any other option. So I'm laughing that this was my my sex education in Poland was religion.
True. I attended the religion classes, but I remember I liked it as a kid, mm-hmm. because I could paint a lot, and you know, all these iconic paintings of Jesus and Holy Mary, and I always had some like feeling that it was a little bit creative work, because we could like, use a lot of like pencils. So I wasn't really thinking about dogmatic aspect of it. I was just like fucking enjoying, you know, pencil work.
Yeah,
but yeah,
you know, I even until today I do like the architecture of church and churchy things. I really like, I don't know, there is something majestic, I guess, about
it's really holistic. It's you can feel the deep spiritual kick when you enter in the areas, like, or areas of cult, let's say that way.
Yeah exactly. And I had a question in my head in regards to all of it and just kind of went away. But yeah, I remember. Because I got myself an old sex education, again in quotation, book from like 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah.
I think it was 1987 when the book was published. And apparently, only for 3 months, this book was in on the bookshelves or in schools. And they were openly discussing sex, intimacy, generally relationships, not in regards of family necessary, but generally interacting between people. And in this book, they ask a lot of really cool questions. Like, I was like, it was really amazing. So apparently this book existed only for 3 months, because then the Polish government got upset, and because it didn't relate it to the family
values.
Yes,
that's I mean, that has to be still, you know, before the liberation, that had to be still in the communist times, which paradoxically in a lot of cases in the legal terms was more flexible for females than what happened after 90. So
even now, you know, like, I even don't think I'm like scared to go back to Poland because of the entire political situation that is happening there. And I'm thinking, okay, if I would happen to be pregnant, and even if it's like, if I want this pregnancy, but then I get sick and it endangers my life or the baby's life, you're fucked. You're literally fucked if you are pregnant and something is happening. And
it's really dangerous. It terrifies me too, thinking of, you know, my female friends being there and looking at that situation, that their lives, their beloved comfort of living, it's constantly in danger.
Yeah.
Because the reproductive health, whether it's planned, whether it's not, it's a kind of like a priority of medical system that should be respected and should treat everyone equally, and pre-selection and selection on which kind of area of a pregnancy damage or your own damage on disease or dysfunction or whatever, you will be applicable to have the right to decide about your own life. It's frightening.
What do you think was the most formative experience for you, either in regards of intimacy or in general? What was the most formative experience for you in your life when you were growing up?
Well, there were a lot of different experiences that I would remember as a building experience is to connect to my body, you know, and how to kind of integrate my self-acceptance, for example, with the self-intimacy. Mm. But what comes to my mind now, it's mainly what I practice now, and I think I've been practicing this since always, but right now it's like in a very conscious level. Mm-hmm. So it's basically to get naked with myself, yeah. Right? And there's like, capture this, there's absolutely zero sexual component to what I'm going to say. I'm not talking about anything that is related to a sexuality. I'm talking more about the experience, which for a lot of people like myself, it's actually a luxurious experience to have a time, space, an option without disturbing anyone around you, to get naked with yourself, to get natural, comfortable, and the most self of yourself, whatever you're going to do. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, like to think about it, like we theoretically, I would say we sleep 8 hours per day. If you're lucky.
Yeah, yes, if you're lucky.
Obviously. So with this time, like theoretically you could get naked to you know, to be carefree and on all natural. A lot of us would choose pajama, but that's not about it. But even if you're naked, you're still sleeping. So it's not really the time when you can, you know, like really consciously get to your like attention about how you feel with your own body, because you're sleeping. And I don't know, unless you are some superhero, lucid dream, I don't know, shaman, then you can do it. But most of us are not. So you don't have this connectivity. And then, you know, you wake up and then 14 hours, you're wearing clothes. So basically, when is the time when you are naked with yourself? Probably if you have sex or getting a shower, but that's that.
Yeah.
You know, and this kind of disconnectivity from myself, like falling outside of myself and being anxious, mainly starts when I know that there was a long period of time when I couldn't feel comfortable with myself being just naked and maybe do nothing. It doesn't require any activity. It's just the kind of sense of nudity and I think for a lot of people it could be maybe, you know, to feel yourself vulnerable, yeah. Maybe to observe if there's some conflict between you and your body in yourself and how this body conscious works on you. So I think that's one of the most like formative but continuously growing practices that I do, and trust me, it's not an easy one when you share all your house with your teenage son. So you know, this practice also requires that you have to do it without traumatizing anyone else around you.
Yeah.
Like you go to the office and run naked because you want to be naked. So it also requires a little self holiday for yourself, even if it's a few minutes per day, to, you know, to get to this sort of experience. So I would say this one, it's pretty much strong in my life.
How was the intimacy for you, or generally the feeling of being intimate, being sexual during the pregnancy?
You know, I was a very young pregnant mother. I was in my very early 20s. So back in the time, I wasn't even, let's say, strongly understanding my own sexual identity. You know, that journey took me many, many years, and it mainly started to happen by the end of my 20s, like beginning of 30s, and I'm now in my late 30s. So it was kind of like, you know, last decade of work. And back then, I was just a baby. You know, I was in the body of a young woman. My emotional capacity, my understanding of, you know, all the cognitive errors, whatever, what's going on in this like universe of mapping of my own brain, wasn't still like developed enough for me to even question the sexuality in terms of self pleasure. In terms of any kinks, fetishes, I mean, kind of like I knew I had that identity, but I didn't even know what to do with it. So the pregnancy time was definitely not time as I remember, largely connected to aspects of sexual life. Mm. It was this incubation time for me, and I enjoy it. I like I said, I was very, very young. I mean, our mothers at that age had few kids, but
yeah,
you know, I think in our age it was pretty much like early. Mm. So it was a very intimate process, though. It was very intimate to observe the body changes. And I remember I liked the body changes because it was exciting for me to see what's coming with the next step. I was lucky. I was healthy. I had very problemless pregnancy as well. Mm-hmm. So I could really focus on what was going on with my body, with you know, how it transforms.
Yeah.
And that was the intimacy part, just in general preparation for the human being to be met soon. But it was not conscious sexual period of my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that the sexual identity, but the exploration of that started a little bit later. Would you mind telling me a little bit more about that? What by sexual identity and how this exploration looked for you?
You know, like, as a human, we are super, super complex in terms of everything. And I would say that sexuality is probably one of the most complex areas. And in my case, as I mentioned in the beginning, coming from a traditional conservative setup of the society, coming from also orthodox family, religious background of the family, that didn't really help into you know, self-exploration and releasing the feeling maybe of guilt or shame or basically even, you know, integrating myself with the theme of sexuality. And nevertheless, I always had a very strong feminist agenda since a very early age of my teenage riot times. I was really fascinated by the feminist movements, and you know, and I also was involved in activism myself. So there were always some women, I would say, I wouldn't say mentor role models, but there were strong females around me representing strong female values. And and with me, that also meant that there is something more than the passive kind of role that I you know, took from the family model and my country or family. But the self-exploration of sexual identity, you know, self-understanding of a pleasure, it was a decade of errors, of a lot of different relationships, sexual and intimate with different people, a lot of observation, a lot of myths about myself and what sex should be, intimacy should be, or could be, you know, and a lot of learnings on the self experience, I would say. So that brought me to this point. And then, you know, there was another point, and there was a lot of self-reflection also on the things that come to you after time.
Yeah.
Because in my case, when I analyzed a lot of my, you know, sexual encounters from, I would say, early sexual journeys, I would say they were abusive. It's just I had no idea.
Exactly.
So this realization comes to you as an adult, and you know, after third or fourth therapy or another, you know, assessment in your life and a lot of different experiences you put together, you come into conclusion that it still fucking hurts.
Yeah.
Because something has been done to cross your boundaries. But back then you had no tools to construct the boundaries.
Exactly. And I totally relate to that. I can relate to that because I can see that even now, when I go back, like, let me just say first that I really love my parents. They are great people. And the fact that my mom was really this strong person, like mentally strong person, taught me to be independent and taught me to not fall into this traditional values of what woman, what role should woman play in a relationship, for example. Not that those are incorrect or wrong, because if it suits to someone, then that's fine. Who am I to question? Unless it crosses certain boundaries and it's abusive and the person doesn't see it, then maybe I would say something, I don't know. But for me, it was great to see, to have this other option of being strong and independent person. And and so my parents are great and I love them. But, oh, wait. Again, fucking lost the thought. But they are great. But the intimacy wasn't a thing in our house. It wasn't really like present. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't observe that. And the boundaries. We talked about the boundaries.
The boundaries,
And so I noticed that when I was going recently home, mm-hmm. and I started expressing my boundaries, because mm-hmm. I learned more about myself and my boundaries and what I want and what I don't want and how I don't want to be treated. So when I got home and expressed that, I noticed that those things aren't respected.
Mm-hmm.
But now I see it.
Yeah,
I haven't seen it earlier. 10, 20 years ago, I would take it as, oh, that's normal. I should just move on and that's it. And the same what you said with relationships, that now when you analyze those past relationships and you have more information now, you see that those were abusive relationships. You weren't respected in that relation.
Yeah, they were not well balanced, right? There was no place to, you know, to be equal. And in terms of there was no discussion about what model of relationship you would like to put yourself in. You were just going in a lot of times. And that's, you know, it's a great experience to have the possibility to reflect on that today.
Mm. Yeah, but from another hand, it's a little bit shame that we had to go through it. Because maybe it would be even better if we didn't go through it. But I also I also see it like, it's an experience for me right now. I'm not going to change it. I cannot travel back in time.
No.
But yeah, I guess my past decision brought me also to the place where I am now. And I enjoy it.
Of course.
Yeah. And, you know, for me, actually getting to work in adult industry. So when I got into the company, started working there as a producer, that was like, an eye-opening experience. Similar background as yours, and then you get into that. It was shocking in the beginning because, for a person who never talk about sex or intimacy and suddenly, bah, here you go. But it's an experience I wouldn't change for anything. I'm really happy I had it, and it taught me really a lot. And I think that was the beginning of my sexual exploration. Also quite late, but because it was in late 20s for me.
Yeah.
But it was amazing. And so I would like to ask you a little bit more about Erobella. Am I pronouncing it right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, awesome. And so how did you decide to, well, maybe not necessarily Erobella, because maybe the work started earlier in the area of sex related work. So how did you decide to enter it? Because I don't think so. It's often that people wake up and it's like, tomorrow I'm going to work in sex tech and I'm like, I'm going for it. I don't know many people
for whom. Probably not. Very few of us would be, but it's always some sort of like ride back through the previous experiences for most of the people from the industry that I at least know. And so I don't think my story is any super special or unique. So right back to 15 years ago, I work in the tech sector already. Mm. And, you know, the working in rather with the white dudes, kind of Regine Supreme Kings and their castles, virtual castles. It's probably meta castles, but that's how I started my career. A very male-centric environment. And that continued for over like 7 years, and I was looking for some sort of place where, you know, I could combine the tech passion, but at the same time I could maybe exercise a little bit more of my feministic kind of activism agenda. And at the same time, I think I realized back then, after 7 years in tech, that if you're a woman and if you have aspiration to be, let's say, C-level executive, I'm not saying global head, like C-level executive, it's going to be a way, way harder for you than the rest of your colleagues and the same network. So then the sex tech kind of came around. That was 7 years ago when I was making the transition from the deep tech to sex tech. And it came to me because it felt back then that this was just the only place I could go. Seriously, whatever I felt about like my ideological background plus my work. And the sex tech back then, 7 years ago, it was something, it was first of all super decentralized. It was all in kind of like different geolocations, very, very unorganized, beginning of something that could be an ecosystem. And but at the same time, it was like really vital. It was sort of edgy. It was rebellious. It was like tech movement, which was mainly represented officially by femme entrepreneurs. Right. So it was a kind of like, okay, I look it upon myself and I felt that's the place where I could go if I'll take few competences of my previous kind of like career experience. And because I was building the tech ecosystems before and the community around the digital brands and products, I first decided to give a chance to create a platform. So that's how the Essex Tech EU platform started, which is now like 6 years after we launched. And that's the global community, sort of like heaven for the professionals from that industry, you know, packing this pleasure, a pleasure kind of centric world. And then for those years, like we worked with basically every segment of this industry. So, you know, everything from wearables, immersive entertainment, pleasure product market, apps, platforms, like everything. But, and like, actually, well, there's no but, because it was thrilling that time for the last, this period of time for me was like fascinating. I really enjoyed to break all this social stigma and taboos, you know, there was a lot of obstacles. And everyone knew that in sex tech, it's not like you go and you knock the door and someone's going to open them for you. It's just like you have to fucking break the walls with you. You know, if you want something, it's like it's a war zone. So it was fascinating, and I made a lot of lifetime great friendships. I developed a lot. I learned a lot about myself and sexual self and intimate self and entrepreneurial self, and all of that was great. Till the time when 2 years ago, I think I started to feel in sex tech like it's too vanilla for me. If I can just say that.
Yeah,
way.
No. Yeah, good.
It started to feel too cozy. It started to feel too disruptible. And, you know, and it started to feel great because we commercialized the pleasure for masses and mainly for vagina clit owners. So, yes, now we have the celebrities talking about our products. We have all the influencers. But at the same time, I felt, okay, it's maybe boring now. You know, it's just something that it's a personal thing. I don't think the industry is boring. It's just that I, maybe it's some sort of, I don't know, like autistic characteristic I have, or it's some sort of like, it's something I took from different incarnations. I don't know. It's like when things become too cozy.
Yes.
I have this need and urge to stir up something.
I understand. More. I get it.
Yeah, and that's what happened 2 years ago after this, five years just working basically with the sex tech category of products. I started to dance closer to a category that some of them say it's adult tech. I mean, okay. I don't like this labels, because for me, every technology that enhances human sexuality, it's a sex technology, but I know that within our industry, some of colleagues prefer to say, no, I'm in sex tech because adult is not ethical. It's like
I have heard that
basement place that yes. I don't want to touch. Do you experience that?
I did have heard that. Well, look, my adventure, let's call it like this, started yeah. in adult industry. Yes. So yeah. I was already on deep waters. I was like, you produce porn? Well, then we're not going to help you. Opening a bank account? No, not possible. Unless you yeah. know people, then hell yeah. yeah. That yeah. was back 10 years ago. And now I know there are some banks that will allow you to open a bank account, mm-hmm. that will allow you to take a loan. And mm-hmm. there are lawyers, like I asked lawyers. So when I was buying the apartment, I needed a loan in the bank, of course. Yeah. And so I asked a lawyer if the bank can reject my application based on the industry that I work in, so adult mm-hmm. industry. She said, absolutely no. In the Netherlands, the bank cannot reject your application because of the legal company that you work in. It was a legal company. Mm-hmm. It was registered, you know, and everything was done right. You know, so it was.
I'm waiting for some like.
And of course, yeah, and of course, some banks already rejected the loan because I work in adult company. And the conversation yeah. with the agency was funny. They called me and it's like, we have a question. Like, would you mind telling us what do
Nature,
you do for
your
work?
Business.
Like, you know, the question, how they formed the question, it was like very like, you're a suspect. Like, just
yeah, yeah.
So what yeah, do you yeah. do for work? Can you tell us? Because we have a problem with application here.
Yes.
And, you know, not
yes. been there. Yeah.
You know the drill. Mm. So for me, I always was already in that adult tech,
mm-hmm.
yeah. as you said. But yeah. I recently start hearing that people say, oh, sex tech? Well, no, that's not adult industry. Oh, it's not sex work. Yeah, that doesn't fall
yeah,
into
there is a sort of differentiation of topics and labels, and some people, you know, feel more comfortable to be behind the tag that has no connectivity whatsoever mm. with adult content, whether it's production, shooting, affiliation, I don't know, marketing or, you know, escorting.
Mm.
And to finalize the part of how I get to the Arabella kind of position was that, yeah, when I started 2 years ago, taking more kind of jobs from the side of adult tech companies and work, you know, with a lot of clients that were mainly representing, I would say, ethical porn, but I also had episodes, you know, with the Tube side as an advisor. Yeah. So I work with kind of bigger spectrum of that angle of the industry. And then I realized, like, okay, come on, like, you know, this is like the biggest neon light right now in the tech world, which is shining away bigger than Netflix, away bigger than Twitter, all the meta together, because if something takes 20% of the global traffic, of the internet traffic, and it's called adult entertainment, then you cannot tell me that this is not serious.
Yeah.
This is bloody fucking serious. This is inherently political. This is the powerful tool, way bigger than the mainstream tools that we know that we use every single day in our phone with our apps. So that for me was like, you know, enough of kind of steam to feel that I'm in the right place. And the Arabella, that was just the natural effect of this. It was like, you know, domino effect that you started mm. something and there's another and there's another project coming to you. And Arabella is very special for me. It's absolutely unique project that I'm like honored to be part of as a co-founder, because it is a sex work marketplace. Mm-hmm. It's a sex work marketplace. It's the third biggest platform at the moment in German market based on the escorting services.
Yeah.
So we are even more stigmatized than you can imagine if you compare the escorting service to any other content creation or shooting platform of distribution.
Yeah. Because, you know, OnlyFans, during pandemic, I feel like OnlyFans became very popular for anyone. And often I saw articles that were saying the men who are doing OnlyFans, look how amazing he is, and because he is doing OnlyFans to support his family. Yes, or no, no, since a man is doing it,
he's
no longer
a
taboo.
He's a hunter.
Yeah, he's awesome. But then any woman who is doing it is like, oh, why she's doing it? Why she's not ashamed of herself? She shouldn't be doing it, you know, all like this differences, and it shouldn't be like this. I don't know, like it's my very simplistic thinking, and I know it's so simple to say, like we shouldn't divide people, like, oh, it's great for men to do it, but for women it's not good, and we are ashamed for that. It's really not cool. But what I wanted to ask you in terms of Arabella is how do you ensure the safety of people who offer their services there? Because I guess it may happen that some malicious behavior will enter Arabella, or I don't know, maybe even as far as sex trafficking may happen, that someone will start offering some services. So how do you ensure the safety?
You know, that is the topic that's like really really huge one, and I could talk about it till tomorrow. So I try to break this down to you in a kind of simple but right to the point way, that whether you are in charge of an online space that is dedicated to whatever sex community. It can be a sex party, it could be a sex club, it can be, I don't know, a dating sex fetish platform, or like in our case, Arabella, it's a marketplace for the sex work. The priority and what should be in your mental spine, it's that safety, it's your priority. It's like you're starting from that, like whether you will jump into that business, you become responsible for each and every user that ever had registered into your platform. So in our case, we created a very comprehensive system of verifications, rating, and all of that. I will just go to this in a moment to explain how it works and our platform. And I don't want to brag about it that we are so great because it's my company, but I am very proud of what we achieved in terms of security systems and prioritization of emergency systems as well. So with our case, each user as a client goes through ID verifications. That's the step number one. You need to be verified by the ID. There is no way that you will enter the platform with being anonymous. When in this journey for the user, it starts also that you will receive ratings and the reviews from the sex workers. So that's very important to create the situation where you know there is a data that informs people around about everything, about the payment process provider, about the vibe, about the hygiene, about your behavior, about basically everything that you do in terms of a dating the chosen person. Now, with this, there's also a system that monitors any suspicious or inappropriate behavior. So sex workers have a right and a choice to report us by the reporting system anything that just seems for them like off or you know, suspicious. So the red flag system, it's also very important for us to analyze what's going on with the user side. And of course it's another tool for sex workers to create safer environment to be in. And now with our platform, we do also something that I believe almost nobody is doing, not just within adult industry, but in general tech industry. So we actually run multilingual call center that works from Monday to Friday by 8 hours per day, communicating in 8 languages, which are chosen languages, but knowing of our data that this can be the mother tongue, primary language of the majority of our sex workers registered within the platform. So in the 2023, you cannot talk to chatbot anymore. You can't really put the responsibility on, you know, ticketing system by sending information to support or hello or info. This should not be even allowed. When we deal with such a highly sensitive safety requirements, there has to be a human being on the other side that is able to pick up the phone, that is able to give you instructions, to hear your opinion, maybe to pick up some very emergency happening situation right now. And it has to be able to communicate perhaps in the language that you understand.
Yeah.
And imagine that Pornhub would have a call center.
Yeah.
You know, perhaps there would be a way less situations on the side of a mind geek if they would put more attention towards the moderation. And first of all, accessibility, because you need to be able to access another site.
Yes.
You know, so in our case, the call center, it's not just a place where sex workers are looking for the information about what to do with the website, how to position their profile or whatever, what happened with this or that future. Mm-hmm. It's often a first contact place for person, watch this out, moving from different country to Germany and seeking for the information about the legal side, consultment, health situation, STD checkups. All of that, it's kind of packed with our system. So our a call center team, it's like really well trained and is really aware of the whole basically consultancy service as well. That's their job.
And how do you train those people, and how do you select the people who will be working in the call center?
Yeah, so the part how we train is also very interesting, because with our platform, we have very close and official collaborations with the major NGO, sex work NGOs in Germany. Mm-hmm. So we are not taking, you know, the consultancy work with our own knowledge. We always seek for the understanding of, you know, how to process and train people, that we seek for advice of those who are spent there 20 years and they know better than we do. Mm-hmm. So we do have a lot of these, I would say, an intersectional partnerships.
Mm-hmm. Like outsourcing, basically.
Outsourcing, but also we work with sex workers, with former current sex workers themselves. Mm-hmm. So we do have them as a brand ambassadors. We do have them as a brand advisors. So before we create, for example, event or a webinar or podcast, we consult with the community.
Yes.
Because, you know, like we can't put ourselves in the shoes of sex workers if we're not. Mm-hmm. We are responsible here to create a space and an environment that's safe for them, as much as it's possible, that's transparent, that's accessible. But then the work needs to be done within unions and communities. And that's the whole kind of, you know, aspect of how you're hiring people. And a lot of times we will hire the actually sex worker who is experienced and who has a lot of more knowledge about dealing with a lot of stuff that we wouldn't know as a team. So that's the part of partnership. But the current and the last, and I'm really, really proud of that one, it's our new app, which we call the emergency app. And of course, no one have done it before. Seriously, but that didn't happen.
I think that's a good sign. Yes,
the fostering innovation, right? Like going with the vibe of a technology, you bring in new solutions. And emergency app is something that we offer to sex workers registered on our platform. But basically, now from the next 2 weeks, every sex worker who is working individually, independently, can use this app for free and doesn't need to be necessarily profiled with our platform. And
So anyone, like even the ones that you are not on your platform?
Yes, that's what we're opening
that's
now.
Awesome.
Because the emergency app, it's a very simple system that allows sex worker to set up the calendar of their dates with the approximate time and location, all details, and emergency contacts that you choose yourself. Mm-hmm. And with the going on a date, it works a very, very simple way. So basically you adjust the timeline. Let's say it's 2 hours.
Yes.
And if in the time of 2 hours and 20 minutes, you're not checking the date as complete, the mm-hmm. system will automatically respond to emergency connections by texting them, sending your precise location and information, what to do, how to help you, contact you, where are you. So, okay.
So if the sex worker doesn't report that the appointment ended,
yeah.
the system will be triggered automatically.
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay.
Yes. And that really depends on the individual kind of setup, because you decide yourself mm-hmm. how much time do you need after date to, you know, to check your phone, how to connect to the system. But basically right now we are opening this future to everyone who's doing the sex work and would be interested to basically having this choice.
Okay, and is it only sex workers in Germany or all over the world?
No. Nowadays, we prepared the last, we are currently finishing the last polish on the future, so it will be globally open. So you could Amazing. Adjust to any time zone, wherever you are, wherever you go, and you can use it for free.
Amazing. And so what's the name of the app?
Well, at this moment, we call it the Emergency Arabella app.
Mm-hmm.
And so it will be, I would say, widely informed to the media mm-hmm. outreach within the next few weeks. I'm also taking this future to Colombia within next weeks. I'm traveling for the Erotic Fest Festival, and it's going to be the first time when I'm going to open this future to a public mm-hmm. with the possibility of downloading.
That's amazing. And did you ever think about taking Arabella worldwide, so offering this not only in Germany but, well, let's say,
I mean, we currently entered the Swiss market, and by the end of the mm-hmm. year we are sure to be launched in Austria, so the Dach region. Mm-hmm. But you know, the entering new marketplaces for the sex work platform, it depends only on the factors of the criminalization and the regulation mm-hmm. of the market. So of course you can only enter those marketplaces which are regulated and legally allow you this possibility of running the mm-hmm. business there. And of course, you know, there's a lot of decriminalized marketplaces all over the world, but from our perspective, we also are not going to the marketplaces that we are not knowing ourselves. So, for mm-hmm. example, the Latin America, it's a very unknown area for us. We are testing the waters now in Europe. And as we grew as a third biggest platform in Germany, the prognosis are very, very optimistic for us to enter the different locations, but that's also require a little bit of time and expansion.
Definitely. And I would like to read a quote that I found on your LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And I have a few questions mm-hmm. about this, what you say there, and it's about Arabella. So uh-huh. starting the quote, at Arabella we have emphasized evidence-based policies through robust research, including a wide-ranging survey on the German sex work market and a partnership with Charit Clinic on a mm-hmm. mental health program for sex workers. So I have a few questions about that.
Sure.
And first one is, what was the research and survey about exactly?
Just a second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, so the research has been done precisely within the German market. Mm-hmm. We were conducting the search through the Arabella platform users, mm-hmm. and the aim of the search was to diagnose various aspects of the sex work conditions. So there was economical status, mental well-being, access to, for example, testing or legal support or any other health essential services. Mm-hmm. And by gathering this data, we tried to also kind of, you know, to create a deep understanding of these dynamics and challenges mm-hmm. that the sex mm-hmm. workers with working in the German market are basically facing in their professional life. So during those surveys, the participants were were sharing their the perspectives also on the how much they're satisfied with their earnings, how much they're dissatisfied, you know, various experiences, including safety of work, conditions of work. All these aspects were taken care of in the aspect in the process of research. And with the Charity Clinic from Berlin, which is currently running massive, like robs, like really in, like really long term deep search focusing on the mental health of the sex workers, we also become to be partners of that another academical search, like hoping for the, you know, a fruitful partnership in terms of understanding how the sex work impacts your mental health and what could be done better within the systems to offer to sex workers access.
And what were some findings from the survey that you can share here and how it impacted the decisions that you make in the business?
Yeah, definitely they had, first of all, the reason of the search was also based on our understanding how to design and conduct support system for sex workers. So before we would enter to, you know, process of creation, dedicated webinars for them, we would need to understand in which areas we should support them first. So we can't take this knowledge from the moon. We have to ask people to understand what they need and where they are. And so there were a lot of conducts on the survey. It wouldn't be possible for me to bring them all here right now, but the most significant and important was highlighting by sex workers that there is a very strong urge and need for the community and union services for them. So majority of them actually conducted that they wouldn't be able to do their work independently without support of a union, of a community, or meetups with another sex workers or NGOs and all of this kind of like non-governmental structure. In terms of safety, I think that was very interesting because we asked them how safe you feel yourself, you feel in your work environment. And with that, 90% of them conducted that they actually feel safe with their with the work, with the concept of the work, while at the same time 60% of them conducted that they had experience digital harassment, violence, for example, including like email harassment or the content theft. So, you know, there were kind of interesting outcomes. On one hand, the sex workers and a majority of them, they were really happy about the earnings. So they were kind of like presenting that the economical situation is actually in the high satisfaction level. That was very important for us, for example, to understand how the market value looks like and you know, how they're also dealing with the self-monetization and understanding of how to value their own business. Because for us, sex workers are nothing and then one person startup doing work for 10 people, you know, it's individual business entity, which need to be treated that the same way. So the understanding of their spendings and accounting and monetization of their business and how to grow the business, it's really very essential knowledge. There was also a part of the STD checkups from the side of accessibility, the knowledge. Majority of the sex workers from our conducted search said that it's a paramount for them, of course. So the in regular checkups, 90% of them check regularly every 2 months within the STD check. So that is another collapse of this big myth, you know, that the sex workers are, of course, the most transmittable sexual disease people among the society, which, of course, it's not even a truth. It's just another myth, which we just, of course, knock out by the results of the survey. So there's a lot of findings, and I'm happy to share the report.
That'll be great. I can link
later after the talk, so you could also link that. So there's a lot of interesting facts because the survey was really, really broad work.
I would love to see that, and I would link to it in the podcast notes. So if you send me the link, I will do that.
Of course.
I have a few different questions in regards to what you say. So STI testing, in my experience, I remember when we were sending the performers to get tested, and that would happen in different countries in Europe, depending mm-hmm. where they were located. And then when they got tested, we would fly them, let's say, to Amsterdam or to mm-hmm. Berlin to do the shoots.
Mm-hmm.
And there was often would happen that the people who work in the clinic, they wouldn't understand why the person needs to do those tests and why they get tested so often. Some performers would say they were mm-hmm. stigmatized by the yeah. employees of the clinics. And I think that's a huge thing, huge problem we should address in the general in sex work. I think yes. it's not only for people who produce adult content. Also, mm-hmm. there is a lot of problems with people actually understanding that they have to get tested, that that's part of their expenses.
You mean on the side of talent, the performer?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Because, mm-hmm. you know, when the company tells you, we will pay for your test results, that mm-hmm. That's great. Yes, it will be covered for you. Mm-hmm. But when you do, meanwhile, also different types of sex work, and you're not getting tested, and for example, so let me take a step back. So sometimes there is misunderstanding of how the STI is transmitted. So for mm-hmm. example, a performer will get tested. We will pay for this as a company. And then afterwards, let's say before the shoot, they mm-hmm. get into contact with someone they have unprotected sex. Either let it be oral unprotected sex or mm-hmm. just penetrative unprotected sex. But they, especially when it comes to oral unprotected sex, they often, well, maybe not often, but sometimes it happened that people didn't see it
as the same, yeah, some importance yeah. to mention.
Yeah, exactly. And they thought that their STI test results are still valid. So I mm-hmm. think there is still place to grow educational aspect when it comes to STI testing.
Absolutely.
And so that's one side, but also the stigma and how the people are treated when they actually going to get tested. That there are a lot of questions asked, and like those questions, it's irrelevant to the fact that I'm just going to get tested and I want to get tested.
Yeah, it's not a secret that the sex workers are highly marginalized and stigmatized in mm. basically every aspect, you know, and yeah. that includes also the medical health system and basic access to the health insurance and the coverage of this insurance of your needs. There are NGOs, thankfully, and in Germany, which are kind of providing the access to testing for the sex workers, and those are specifically working with the unions and providing not only the access to testing but also list of the locations within the Germany where you could go as a sex worker and receive mm-hmm. the testing for free, mm-hmm. Or with a small payment, and those are so to call sex worker friendly mm-hmm. Locations that we also in Arabella are aware of, and we will always of course recommend the sex workers if they look yeah. for a specific place for testing to go to one of these facilities. So there is a possibility to you know to do that maybe with a less stigma and without essentially explaining yourself that you are here for whatever reason. But that is something that might be difficult for migrants. Mm-hmm. Let's be honest. If you're migrating to another country, European country, as a, I don't know, asylum visa or any other process of migrating a visa, mm-hmm. It might be difficult for you to get the health insurance. Most likely you won't have it. And most likely those places will not support you without having the actual kind of policy of mm-hmm. payment of your services. Mm-hmm. So that is the gap with accessibility. So we have not enough, I would say, independent sources supporting the sex workers, especially these without conditions of being able to pay for the regular testing, without access to regular testing. So that is a really big problem.
Agree. And did ever happen that someone report or someone created an account for a sex worker, and this account wasn't operated by the actual sex worker?
We can't really conduct such a such a data, because and like I said in the beginning, to become the whatever client versus sex worker registered on the platform, you need to be you have to deliver your ID. So now with that ID, of course, you have to kind of prove it. It's like on the shooting. It's like on the shooting with a lot of ethical productions, at least, that you place the ID next to yourself, right? Mm-hmm. So you can be identified. And of course, like, you're filling up the data, you're filling up your profile. And with our case, if we would see, for example, if we call the person with registration and we'll find out that, you know, let's say the person is not operating any of the languages, but the profile is perfectly, you know, done in German, might be suspicious, right? But of course, it could be also like just ask up someone else to help you fill in the profile. It's very hard to really get to that point to say this profile could be done by solicitor or pimp. Most likely, you have to use your personal data. This data is monitored, and you know, we are sending a lot of notification messages to our users, and we also regularly checking that data status. So it's like really tightly moderated. But I would say there's always a passage. There's always a passage that someone can use that you will not be aware of, and it's very hard to say whether this ever happened in our case, because we haven't ever received such a report of abusement of someone's personal data yet. I think it's just my personal opinion that this risk grows when you grow. That this risk growing with the company traffic and at the moment when we are operating basically two countries, it's still, you know, with our system, with our technological support and the cybersecurity support, it's still possible with our moderators to really be within accurate. When you grew to the size of a Pornhub, Hamster, tube site, it's becoming more complicated.
Yeah.
Because I just compared your question to, for example, the question of why tube sites, for example, are having such a loud moderation. You know, when you are basically scrolling through 20% of global traffic data through your company process, hiring maybe not enough moderators. I don't know what's going on with those company structures, but I know that the moderation is the key. And I also hope that soon the AI will bring us some solutions that will help us to identify the accounts in a better way.
Mm-hmm. How do you think that would work?
Facial recognition, maybe. Yeah. Voice recognition. Hard to say, but I would expect that this will happen.
Yeah. I think it's really it's hard thing to resolve when it comes to knowing who really filled the data, because I remember in the past when I was working in the company, and someone applied to work with the company as a performer, we of course would have a call with them, like Skype or Zoom or Google call, just so we can see the person, so it wasn't only a phone call.
Yeah.
And I remember only one instance when something wasn't feeling really right, and you could sense that behind the camera, somewhere around there was a person probably telling this other person what to do, or giving some signs, what to do, what to respond. But generally, you know, you cannot really say if behind someone applying for the work, there isn't someone standing behind that person and telling them what to do and what to apply for and what work to do. But I guess it's the same with many other businesses. It's just maybe this one is, I don't know if delicate is the right word, but
It's a sensitive one, and that's why it requires, you know, super moderated tools that will help you to tie up the security checks and systems. And those systems, they also need to be upload and check in regular frames. So it cannot be that, you know, whatever data that you just uploaded and I don't know, a year ago hasn't been checked, the account is not being, you know, reactivated unchecked, like even from the cybersecurity perspective, you know. Mm-hmm. it's very important. So but like I said, everything always, and my feeling, depends on the scale and how fast you grow, and that always brings the kind of margin of the mistake. I wouldn't like to call this a mistake, but of a risk.
Yes. About the payments providers, did you have any troubles finding a payment provider, and or did you have any troubles with them when it came to that it's a sex related business?
I had a lot of journeys with the German banks within the last 8 years, you know, including that I was rejected from the bank contract, and later on one of my banks that was operating my money for many years suddenly decided to close up my account, basically freeze my account from receiving any other transactions till I actually had to prove that my core of a business, it's not breaking the terms and conditions of mm-hmm. of whatever in their kind of definition was the term and condition mm-hmm. with adult entertainment business.
And how did you prove them wrong, let's say?
You know, basically when you live in Germany, your life depends on how many lawyers do you have and how many legal insurance you pay for. So you can't really fix your, you know, smallest issue with, I don't know, like leak of the apartment without proper legal representation. So of course, whatever we do here always require us to be equipped with a group of lawyers, which will advise you on how to breathe, how to move, how to eat, and, you know, mm-hmm. how to pay your bills.
Yeah.
And the same was, of course, with the case with the banking. I seek the legal advice and representation with that case, and it took 6 months where I had to very precisely prove to my bank that the incomes I receive from the companies that I work, it's not connected anyhow to soliciting. Mm-hmm. And in matter of fact, there was no official accusation of that. There was no any official mm-hmm. status against me. And I'm talking right now about a private account. So that's also kind of bizarre, you know. Mm-hmm. But I was in a situation when I had to prove them innocent. Until that time, my assets were, of course, frozen. And there's nothing more scary in life, I can say. There's nothing more scary and humiliating, and at the same time, like, frightening when you walk up to reality that without any reason and any foursome, like any crime committed, you are losing access to your asset. Mm. And until you've proven that whatever person A or B or whatever type of accusation it was is wrong, it's going to be like that. So, I highly encourage everyone from the sex tech adult industry to never be dependable on, you know, one source of a filia of your company. You need to have three filias. You need to have a company register in several countries and across the, for example, European Union, to be able to secure your cash flow, to not wake up in the situation when one bank account doesn't work, then, you know, there's an impact whatsoever on your general flow of a company. This cannot happen, but this can happen because we are working in a highly risk environment. Yes. Industry. Therefore, you know, you need to know how to play this game, and with a lot of a painful experience I had, I also, you know, took conclusions with how to, you know, secure myself in a better way and to be never dependable on maybe one country bank system. Yeah. Maybe it's important to also, you know, think how to expand abroad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. I admit that's a really good point to have, like being registered in different countries and seeing how, you know, if accidentally one day you wake up and your bank account is closed and you no longer can you're allowed to running the company in this country, you have a backup plan. Because sometimes creating this backup plan can take months. So you don't wanna...
Exactly.
Yeah, you don't want to wait another for 6 months before you can again run your business, because you're kind of losing momentum and the clients.
True.
I feel like, and I think we a little bit talked about this, or you mentioned it, is that it's easy for, I feel like it's easier for people to accept the use of sex toys, let's say. It's some kind of maybe more glamorous right now, maybe on like a fashion thing. and sex toys are an example, then accept sex work. Like if someone says, oh, I'm using sex toys and it's so amazing and everything, and then someone says, oh, but I use the services of sex worker, that's more stigmatized and there is big silence in the room.
Oh, yeah.
And why do you think one is easier than the other one? Why it's structured like this?
Oh, well, that's that would require a move a little bit again in time, time travel, yeah, to look in the history of the pleasure product market and the history, mm-hmm, of the sex toy. So, because this history is like real, real roller coaster ride, you know.
Okay.
And I always say that some things are digestible and some things are just stuck in your throat. And that's something that comes to my mind when I hear why sex toys are, you know, publicly, socially acceptable and the sex work is stigmatized. So basically the story of the sex pleasure product market started in the 80s in US, and it started from paddlers going from home to home, selling the, you know, magic devices to housewives, so they could more entertain their husbands. So basically the sex toy market was marketed for men through the housewife, yeah, to receive the product, right? So that was this kind of paddling house to house sales. Not also many people know that magic wand success comes thanks to the 80s VHS porn product placement. So the magic wand first appeared there. So again, it's a male-centric market, right? So
yes,
that time, it's still magic wand as a symbol, today symbolically iconic toy. It came basically thanks to popularity of a porn.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so what happened, then we enter this era of this red curtain boutiques, right? So the sex shops are opening. And again, if we think logically, sex stores, shops in the 90s were still male-centric. It was a place for the guys to go to buy the VHS. And then they were, the way, there is some, like, straight dildo, obviously just designed from dudes to, you know, fulfill their fantasy of how the women would be penetrated with that probably disgusting looking item, not functional.
Yeah. So
again, it was really, really male-centric market. And then the internet changed the narration, and the e-commerce changed everything beyond the point of recognition. And now, guess what? We have products which are designed for women. They are designed for clit owners and vagina owners. And that changes everything, right? So with that change with the industry, it didn't just change how the R&Ds and engineering of a product start to design product accessible like for women, but there were like, you know, billions of huge marketing campaigns worth of $1 million to sell this product to women. So of course, it all was wrapped with this female empowerment.
Yeah.
As there had to be, female empowerment packaging was basically financed with the massive campaigns. So from there, that went to celebrities promoting the pleasure products on the social media, whatever. This started this influence sex toy marketing that really boosted the sales, and that became to be mainstreamized. Mm-hmm. Commercialized, mm-hmm, right? So it, like you said, it becomes to be trendy. It's sort of status, also depending on how many lilos do you have, because if you have some, you know, shitty Amazon $1 worth toy, then you're not mentioning it to your friends. Yeah. So that is also kind of status of how cool you are and what you can afford, and you know, and that is kind of boosting this big sales and great marketing. So of course, this is this part that is digestible. Everyone digested. Yeah. It's disruptible. It's disrupted. Like, you don't have to convert those who are converted. But now we come to sex work. And this is a completely, how we say in Polish, different pair of shoes? No.
Yeah, different pair of shoes. Yeah.
So that story. will be the different pair of shoes, because we have moral objections. Now, like, it comes to the fact that everyone has something to say and it's going and will question how someone, a reading woman, can freely decide to monetize her own body. Like, how this came to this is the part of moral judgment. And then we opening all the politics, so decriminalization, lack of legal protection, like lack of access to services, health systems, any support, and this creates this sort of like it's like maze. And the sex workers are there and try to find the entrance, but they're blindfolded.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like really, really absurd situation. And on the top of that, like, just compare the pleasure product marketing and on lifestyle media. So it's really now like accessible, like the lifestyle media, health media, they promote pleasure products because it's a wellness component.
Mm.
Right, we were fighting for this for years to make the pleasure component of wellness. So it's self-care. And now look how the media presenting the sex work topic. Mm-hmm. So with 90%, it will be not a sex work. It will be the forceful sexual crime victim.
Yes. Yeah.
Being presented, headlined with a very, I would assume, clickable, traffic likable statement quote of a victim on the first page.
Yes.
And I'm not saying with that we need to stop listening to victims, or the victims are not existing of forceful sexual crimes, because they do. And we need to give places to victims to be heard. But at the same time, we can't mix the forceful sexual crimes and human trafficking with the sex work, because those are completely two different labels. They're different type of kind of categories.
Yeah.
But the media mix them all together, and then what we receive from the media picture is usually, you know, the sex worker means the mentally broken, drugged up, mm-hmm. forced to this profession person.
Mm.
In my opinion, it's just like purely like humiliating and downright unrealistic bullshit.
And I think we shouldn't, how do you say that? So we shouldn't put all sex workers in one basket. We shouldn't put all film producers in one basket, because when one does something wrong, or there is something wrong, it doesn't mean that everyone is wrong, or that everyone functions in the same way.
Yeah.
Every person is different, and every person have a different reason to do what they do. And
of course,
some sex workers are more open about the work they do there, and other people maybe cannot be that open.
Of course,
that's fine too. But I think we have the habit of putting one label on everyone. As soon as someone hears sex work, it's like, oh, you're all the same. I know who you are. Yata yata. And I think that's really damaging and harming, because it's like we have this, we are quick in making judgment. We want also quick answers, and we don't try to dive into really learn about the other person.
No. You know what comes to my mind? We did some social experiment about a year ago with Arabella.
Mm.
It's actually very, very cool stuff. We created two fake profiles on Tinder.
Mm-hmm.
So we basically use stock picture of a person, and we create two fake identities. And one identity person was a nurse. Another one was a sex worker. Basically, there was no difference in bionic data. Like, the age was the same, they look the same, they have same hobbies, but we just give them two different jobs. Mm-hmm. And so we listed that for 10 days to see what's going to happen. I don't have this data results in front of me at the moment, but I would say that, let's say, Anna, which was the nurse, and Natalie, which was the sex worker. So Anna scored over 360 matches. You know, the majority of comments, DMs were like very polite, and it was like gentle flirting and association to her work and the reference that she must be a very gentle, open, like, caring person as a nurse. You know, there was all built up fake world around the fake fucking stock picture that we placed there about who Anna could be. And at the same time, Natalie, which was the sex worker, she received maybe 12 matches all over after 10 days. And the messages that were sent to her, those DMs were mainly like obnoxiously offensive.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember one of the DMs was like, and you're a sex worker and you're looking for fucking love, something like that, you know. So to compare those two worlds together by, you know, the judgment of the picture and the only difference between those two identical, you know, fake personalities, yeah, profiles, was their profession, yeah, shows exactly, you know, how the society like give itself a right to judge and comment and also offend sex workers. So of course, with a lot of people working within the industry, they try to do everything to keep the identity, the real identity, in a secret.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not everyone needs to step out of the closet as a sex worker. And there is very few people who actually have this luxurity and support and safety to do that.
Mm-hmm. Also makes me think about pornographic films, because as soon as someone decides to be in front of the camera, they lose the ownership of the media in a way that they don't decide who will see it or who will interact with the video in different ways. Sometimes the video, even if the companies say that they use the video in a certain way, if the content is stolen, no one knows where it will end up, who will see it. And once something is published online, it stays there forever. So I think it increases the risks, because then people really, like, if they can recognize you, they know that you do sex work. It's not, it loses this anonymity.
Yeah.
You are there and you have to deal with that. When it comes to different types of sex work, I think, please correct me if I'm wrong, I think there is still this ability of being anonymous and deciding how much you want to reveal to other people.
Depends, and not really. I mean, as you know, as a technology kind of foster the sex work to be fully digitalized, you are also depending largely on the profiles that are online. So a lot of sex workers are, of course, that's why Arabella exists, because we are the marketplace for the sex workers to exactly, provide them the best possible traffic to their profile as they could get. And at the same time, we conduct this work online 100% these days. So no one is anymore, you know. Of course, there are workers which are working for brothels and agencies, but even agencies, they do have the websites, they do have the online catalogs, they do use platforms like Arabella and the like to advertise their sex workers through it. So I would say it's same. I would put this as equal for the shooting.
I think
for
you're
the
right.
For the escorting, because you have to get a client base. You need to build up the visibility. You need to have the traffic these days.
Yeah, I think you're right with the digital media, with digitalization of the work. It goes everything in this direction. That's a good point. And so how do you think, or how do you see the future of sex tech, of sex and sex work, because people do have sex with robots, which I have learned recently. I mean, it was somewhere in the back of my head, but recently I did the podcast about sex in space and robots and everything. So I had to dive into this topic, do my research. And people do have sex with robots. Maybe it's yet not on super high level, but we are going there. It's going to happen. And how do you think it will influence the, on quotes, old school sex work? Is it going to be helpful? Not really. How it's going to change the area of sex work in general? Hard question, I know.
Yeah. You know, like by working for over like the 8 years with the, I don't know, I'd say 180 products from the sex tech world, and being so well aware of, you know, the progress with the AI and machine learning and possibilities of sexual interactions with the humanoids, I'm still not very much convinced that that tech will, you know, completely take us over anytime soon. And there is a lot of why not on my list. And first of all, it's still very much sci-fi kind of futuristic dream rather than physical possibility. It's still very expensive. It's still not possible to commercialize in the way that would go to masses anytime soon. I'm not talking here about the AI. I'm more talking about like the physical constructed body functional robot, like Harmony AI or whatever Realbotix is. It's behind. And for me, the biggest innovation already is starting and it's already happened. And if you look on the takeover OnlyFans, that's already kind of answer of how the sex work could be revolutionized and had been done. And I think that what happened with OnlyFans when they, I think they grew from 12 million to 29 billion, like within 4 years. It's a proof that this is kind of like pleasure industry, digital carnival. So, you know, like we had never had situation like this before, that you from your like comfortable space at home from your laptop can basically enter as many as you want sexual encounter experiences with like just 5 minutes you know, logging to one or second account. So the escorting and the classic soliciting kind of view on the escorting sex work area also changed completely, right? So we do not really, so we are in the times when the sex work is democratized. So on the one hand, OnlyFans gave that power to content creators, so took them less from the position of being, you know, like applying to a studio and going to casting, and that process completely changed, you know, because now content creator is the most powerful one. The content creator is the one who has 1 million of followers on the Instagram, or all of this OnlyFans-ish kind of like platforms is monetizing itself, doesn't really need to have studio anymore, doesn't need to have a contract with the brothers anymore, doesn't need to. But again, I'm not saying that the studio work will disappear, not at all. But what I'm saying, this OnlyFans market, because for me, it's just like the Airbnb basically for the adult industry, within a bunch of economy. So with that in mind, we observe like big democratization of the sex work. And the same goes with the platforms like Arabella. So everything that is bringing the traffic to the, in support of independency of the sex work is already like really, really huge step. And I see this as a big kind of sex tech innovation. For me, this is huge innovation. And traditionals, I mean, you know, there is a data that stands that over 1 million men per day pay for whatever type of the sex work service in Germany. Like imagine 1 million dudes today, they just already paid the money for the sex work service. And now when you think about it, comparing to the traditional and innovative. So could you imagine that this 1 million of guys who today paid for the sex work would also order 1 million of flashlights? or that would they maybe pay for Oculus VR glasses, and maybe they would spend the money for the VR connectivity, and then, you know, they will enter the immersive world with the same kind of easy access as they could just book an escorting service.
I don't think so. They would like some maybe. Well, that's my thought. Yes, I'm like, and I don't think so. They would so easily do it, because we, if we get used to something, we like to stay in this way, and it's hard for us to, for example, try something new. So if people are used to the traditional system of escorting, I think maybe for some of them already it was difficult or challenging in some way to go online to find, to browse to so many options, and maybe that was, you know, because it's a, it's an adjustment. So I think it will take time for people to start spending even more money to have some devices that will help them to connect with people in more electronic way, not like person to person, I think. But hey, correct me if I'm wrong, because as I'm saying, I don't, like, I'm not very technological human being. When I first heard about ChatGPT, I freaked out, and it took me some time to adjust and to learn and to see the good aspects of it. So yeah, I'm this sort of type.
I would say there are reasons why this 1 million of guys will not purchase the flashlight, or will not enter with some, you know, VR porn game today. First of all, within interaction with a sex toy, you need to create yourself a space that's intimate for you. You need to have a time to also to secure this only for yourself. And then imagine yourself, you know, sharing apartment with your children, with your wife. It's very mostly unlikely that you will even bring this product out of your own shame as a male to your household. More technologically developed solutions like the ER, like the VR immersive experiences, requiring not only space, physical space to install your gear, to you know, to connect yourself to the gear, but also requires money, and it's not cheap. So an average person wouldn't rather spend 1,000 euro just to try some VR porn. And in the end of the day, the sex work, and now I'm just referring to a segment of the escorting, it still gives you something that the AI will never give you. It gives you something that the flashlight or any other sex tech will never give you. It gives you actually real human emotions. The connection within the sex worker, it's not just the, you know, the consumption of the body to body. It's also the conversation. It's also the interaction with another human being. It's also a place where often you can be heard. So the replacement of our capacity to be emotional, in my opinion, will never be replaced by the AI, because AI and whatever products like the like robotics products, they learned from our keywords and our phrases, and they can learn a lot about us, and they can be responsive with their kind of mechanical voice, but they will never feel anything.
You see, I'm with you on that. I'm very much with you, and at least I believe I'm with you on this, because I feel the same. Like last time a friend of me, like it was on a photo shoot, and I was assisting there, and she goes and says like, oh yeah, AI, this will destroy us, it's coming, yada yada. I'm like, no, look, like, do you ever see a robot coming over here and replacing my other friend, the photographer, and interacting in the same way how she's interacting with the models? Like, I don't see it happening. She's giving them this feeling of, like, the emotional feeling. And, you know, happiness also, and everything. But then, as I told you earlier, I did this podcast with a guy who is researching space sexology and aerobotics. And he told me that there are like five steps of how AI can, artificial intelligence can think and process the thoughts. And so I think, if I'm correct, if I remember correctly, he said that ChatGPT would be on like third level, but there is fourth and fifth. And those levels are where artificial intelligence is learning how to learn, how to have your have their own thoughts and, I don't know, perhaps emotions, but I don't know if you would call it emotions. So, yes, I'm saying...
The mimic emotions, for sure. I mean, if you're looking in that kind of that... Because it's double-edged sword.
Yeah.
So on one hand, you know, the artificial intelligence, it's like really embracing kind of mechanism that can help us so much. But if we look on the deep fakes... Mm-hmm. Right now, that's kind of very popular, the deepfake, the adult content.
Yes.
There are villains, right? This is crazy. This is creating manipulated, non-consensual, explicit content that actually it's threatening safety of sex workers. So within always comes some advantage and disadvantage. And of course, you know, we might be now all shitting our pants, being scared that, you know, that the artificial intelligence is going to take our jobs and the content creators will never have to be, they will be not needed anymore. And the writers are scared and the journalists and photographers and everyone, all the creatives right now, basically, right? This is a big topic everywhere you go, whatever you do, creative work, and you hear the AI, it's like, I don't want to hear about this shit. But on the other hand, It's very hard to predict that component, which is like essentially in human being, our core. I believe it's in our core, which is kindness, forgiveness, compassion. Those are the like constructive values of human beings, which it's very hard for me to imagine that you will be able to replicate, even with the most smart system, using the most, you know, comprehensive language, metaphorical phrases. It's still the feeling, you know, that you have to feel in yourself when they interact with me, whether you like me, when I piss you off, when you feel that I love you with the tears in my eyes. That's a completely different level of interaction. And I'm still standing in the position that as much as we will be getting closer to perfectly humanoidized, you know, learning machines, it will be probably not possible to recreate this core feeling.
I'm with you on that. It's, you know, when I have conversations about AI, I'm just like, no, it's the emotions, the kindness, the feeling of how you feel about another person, you know, the gut feeling, what they say.
Exactly, the gut feeling.
Yeah. But from another hand, when I see some other arguments, I'm like, oh, I think it's terrifying.
Yeah, it's powerful. Yeah, it's really something that it's transitional and it's powerful and it can be used in a good and a bad way.
Mm-hmm. And it's important, this element of kindness and emotions and being able to relate to another human being is really important in any sort of sex work, in my opinion. The kindness and being able to communicate with another human being, not treating everyone as the same. Every person is different and they need different approach. It's one of the key elements of the workshop that I do. And I really feel like this is so important. Even if we call it sex tech, I think the aspects of being human are really, really important in this area.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Hola. I think here is a good place to end our conversation. Thank you so much. It was awesome to listen to you. It was super interesting. Is there anything that you would like to add?
I just like to add that it's a great time this year in October again, happening in Berlin, to be in Berlin, to come to visit Berlin and attend the Essex Tech EU conference, which is like this huge umbrella of all the sex and pleasure products and services together in one place, just one time per year. So if anyone is interested more to dive in the world of sex technology and adult technology, I highly encourage you to go to our website, which is www.sxtech.eu, and scroll down to the program and check the agenda, what's coming next, and book your tickets.
Mm-hmm. And I will link to that also in the podcast notes. And if someone would like to get in touch with you, how can they do it?
Please just follow me on the Instagram, which is Ola. I think it's Ola, and there is a at SX. I have to check my Instagram. Gosh, yeah,
I never remember that either. Like,
actually, I will link maybe to that let's also, keep the Instagram. So. I think that my email also will do the job. And I'm sorry, guys. I'm just because I'm so non-active on my Instagram since almost the 1 year, so I'm not even like recognizing my own Instagram name. So the email is ola@sxtech.eu, and that's also the fastest, I would say, way to get to me.
Super. I will add this information. If you want, I can also add the Instagram. I will dig into it and then I post it. But as you say, if you are not active there, then
sure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.